Hello, I'm Shrantha Holochak, the founder and CEO of Uma, an Ayurvedic beauty and wellness collection. This is the Uma Elements podcast. Each week, I'll be having a conversation with someone I greatly admire on the topics of Ayurveda, holistic healing, spiritual well-being, and alternative health. By sharing wisdom together, we will unlock a secret that as ancient as they are, Ayurveda and other ancient modalities are as modern and relevant today as ever.
Dr. Swetha Srivastava Vikram is an international speaker, best-selling author of 14 books, grief coach, trauma-informed yoga teacher, adjunct professor, and doctor of Ayurveda, who is committed to helping people thrive on their own terms. Her latest book, The Loss That Binds Us, 108 Tips on Coping with Grief and Loss, was released on April 2, 2024. As a trusted source on health and wellness, most recently appearing on NBC, NPR, iHeartRadio, and Radio Life Force in a documentary with Dr. Deepak Chopra, Swetha has dedicated her career to writing about and teaching a more holistic approach to creativity, productivity, health, and nutrition. Her work has appeared in the New York Times and other publications across 9 countries on 3 continents. Swetha holds a master's in strategic communications from Columbia University. I'm very excited to be chatting with her today. Swetha, as I was just saying, I'm so delighted to have you on this podcast. There is so much about your wisdom, your expertise, your technique, your advice that I can't wait to both imbibe personally in my life and share with our audiences. You've done such tremendous work in the spaces of mental health and grief in particular. Ayurveda informs your insight in a manifest way, and I can't wait to talk all about that. So welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Shrantla. Am I saying your name correctly?
You are Shrantla, yes.
Shrantla, yeah. So it's so nice to be having this conversation with you. It feels very familiar and comfortable, and I love what you're doing for Ayurveda, raising the awareness, building a community, supporting other practitioners. It's rare. So really grateful for the work that you do and for bringing me on your podcast.
Gosh, I feel such a strong sense of symbiosis here because, you know, Ayurveda was shared with the world so generously by sages thousands and thousands of years ago. And I feel so grateful that a modern day sage as yourself is willing to volunteer her time and share your wisdom with the world. And I feel fortunate that we have a bit of an audience and a platform and can serve as an conduit for spreading the wisdom. So thanks are mine to give and welcome again. Let's start with a little bit about you. I know a lot about you, but I'd love for our audiences to get to know you a little bit better.
So I'll start with the formal byline that I send and then I'll get into I am not that serious a person. I promise. Like, that's the one thing that I tell all my clients is, yes, we'll walk away with tips, but also 3 bad jokes. Like, you have to have fun. Life cannot be taken that seriously. Be serious well about said. The work that you do, but don't have to take it that seriously. So I am an Ayurvedic doctor. I'm an author of 14 books, a grief coach, a trauma-informed yoga teacher, and an adjunct professor. And what I realized was with Ayurveda, there's this, what you just said, Shrantha, it's so beautiful and it's ancient and it's palpable and it's the science of life, but people don't always have access to it. So I wanted to become that bridge, that storyteller, because, you know, storyteller communication, so that's one background and so is Ayurveda. How do we bring them together? And people would tell me, oh, they're two separate things. I was like, stories connect us. Stories don't just have to be about something you define as story. Stories could be about anything, and there's a story everywhere. And I realized in my Ayurvedic practice, stories is what helps me connect with my clients, with collaborators like yourself, because that's the common denomination, right? That's the common factor. We all have experiences. And that was the more formal spiel, so to speak. But personally, you know, growing up in an Indian home, Hindu family, and I put in the religion angle because in India, it matters, right?
And, you know, and as we've talked about sometimes on the podcast, there is a cultural connotation to Ayurveda that must be recognized. You know, the food practices, things that Ayurveda is informed by, but by no means is bigoted about, does have a cultural and religious influence. So please.
Absolutely. And it is the science of life. So nobody owns it. It's like you live it, you practice it, you benefit from it. But the reason I brought up that the religious background is because, you know, I saw my grandmothers, my nani, my dad, like dad's mom, my mom's mom, doing certain rituals in their temple, in the mandir at home. And people used to have a big temple at home, right?
Yeah.
But my mother, more so, she was a brilliant cook. Like in the 80s, she had a pasta maker. She was like unique for a generation.
Wow.
Yeah, she was. It was like no one can match a standard. So like it's very difficult to impress me with even simple food.
Those can be hard moms to be with sometimes, but I digress.
No, 100%. I have to tell them, yeah, I love to cook, but not at the scale what cooking means to you, writing means to me. Mm-hmm. So let's just respect that. But having said that, you know, she wasn't an Ayurvedic doctor. She wasn't an Ayurvedic practitioner, but she was a healer. And the way Ayurveda is so intuitive and instinctive, that's who she was. She knew exactly if someone had had a heart attack, what kind of meals to prepare for them. Because she knew her spice rack. She knew kitchen was her access to apothecary. My grandmother's new mantra chanting could make a difference in your mental well-being, in how you showed up. You know, so there was... But the unfortunate thing was because they weren't educated in the Ayurvedic system, they didn't always have the evidence to back up what they were saying. So, you know, and that's a big challenge with a lot of Indian families or South Asian families, especially Indian families, right? Where if people didn't have the science, many others didn't take it seriously. But now we have all this evidence. Yes. Why do we add ginger? Why is it that we save mustard seeds for winter and not for summer? So she would say all of these things. And like the doctors would be astonished. And, you know, in India growing up in those days, people cook for each other.
Yeah.
It wasn't just for dinner parties. Oh, your neighbor is sick. I'll cook. A third cousin, uncle-in-law is sick. I'll bring him to the hospital. And they were like, what are you doing? It's like magic. And, you know, in reflecting upon it now that she's no longer with us, it's, she knew exactly the food combination. Like my mother would say, don't mix dairy with meat.
Yeah.
Right? So it's, you know, and when I moved to New York, I heard that from my Jewish friends. And I was like, see, the old world cultures knew the science. They might not have necessarily shared why not to do it, but so they've been talking about this, why certain meats are good for you, why certain meats aren't good for you. So I think that was my background. And I grew up with all of this knowledge. But hello, typical teenager, rebellious, didn't want to do anything what everybody else was doing. So I started my career with sports nutrition and worked for Kellogg's. And it was when I was doing my internship with some archery academy football, I was working with athletes. And I was like, why is it that someone who grew up in the mountains is eating the same food as somebody who grew up around sand and camels?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find that answer in sports nutrition and hence started my pathway to Ayurveda. But I still won't admit I was a closeted Ayurvedic enthusiast. Because, you know, I'm like, oh, I work for Kellogg's and all of that stuff. But the other thing was like the reason I keep coming back to the writing and storytelling is it's that's how I breathe and teach and educate and survive myself. So I realized I was going back to a writing retreat in New England every year with a bunch of my friends. Some of us had new projects every year. Some people came back with the same project, like year after year, decade later, it was the same book. And that's when I started putting in Ayurvedic perspective is like, oh, the diet and lifestyle impacts productivity. The diet and lifestyle is impacting your creativity. It's your mind. You know, if what kind of a mind, what mahagunas are out there that's impacting your productivity, creativity. So what, and then finally, you know, I lost my mom over 10 years ago. It became, no, I want to not just use and teach and help others become more creative and productive, but also help people heal. Because she died suddenly, unexpectedly, very young. And we didn't have an answer from Western medicine. They just told us a clinical thing. This is what happened. And I'm like, no, Ayurveda tells you there's six stages. At what stage did we not catch it that it became a sixth stage and she was just gone? And I think so what started as helping writers and creative professionals with their creativity and productivity and their deadlines also became, no, unless you're well and balanced, productivity and creativity really mean nothing. Like, you have to restore your mind, body, spirit back to balance, to not fall sick, because it's only when, and I forget, there's a quote, right? Like, just because you haven't been diagnosed with an illness doesn't mean you're healthy. I'm paraphrasing a beautiful quote. And that's something that I started to believe. Like, how are we looking at well-being? It's not just the absence of a disease. How are we doing with the mind? How are we doing spiritually? And I just gave you an example today of my commute thing, and I can talk about it later. And it was such reiteration of why our mind practices are so important in how we show, because the universe won't curate a situation. Oh, this had this beautiful call with Shrankala. People just see that. There's so many things you've dealt with in the morning, I've dealt with in the morning. But when we show up 500%, it's because we've done certain practices to be fully present.
So much in there, Swetha, because even as you started and you talked about your mom as a healer, such a manifest concept of Ayurveda, right in there, which is, you know, sort of we start healing with food. Right. And, you know, you dropped a massive nugget of Ayurveda in there. And then the second thing you said about cultural practices shared by us, shared by your Jewish friends, shared anecdotally among so many communities. But one of the things that somehow has gotten hammered into us is to ignore intuition, which mm-hmm. is what many of us, many of our cultures may have been doing, because they know through intuition, anecdotes, that some stuff doesn't work for the body well. And now science is finally starting to prove it. So one of the things that often happens with people on their Ayurvedic journey is, when unfortunately traditional science has either failed them or they've not trusted their intuition, because sort of a one-size-fits-all approach. But you touched on that this lives within us as communities, as individuals, that we kind of know even without knowing why, that right. some stuff doesn't work. And the third thing that I can't wait to unpack more is sort of like that concept of absence of disease and thinking you're well just because right now it may have not manifested. And very profoundly, how we tend to ignore mental wellness in ways that really impact our happiness and well-being, but because it hasn't presented as a giant skin disease or hair fall or something in the body, we tend to brush it aside and say, I can deal with stress. I can deal with the fact that I'm not 100% creative. I'm not 100%. And right. I can't wait to unpack that with you. Starting out with, so what does balance look like in the mind? What does mind wellness look like as qualities from an Ayurvedic perspective that we should watch for?
I love this question. So last night I was giving a talk on restorative powers of Ayurvedic cooking at an entrepreneurial space in Manhattan. And we started talking about Rajas, Tamas and Sattva. And that's what I want to speak about here. Because
yes, please. We don't talk about some of that enough.
And because, you know, people are obsessed and fascinated and curious about doshas. But doshas are all about the body, the physiological aspect. When it comes to psychology, we're thinking about the mahagunas. And I asked people in the room, like, can I get a show of hands who practices yoga? And 95% of them. And I was like, have you heard the word sattva? They were like, yes. And I was like, I'm sure you've been told be sattvic. But, you know, that's the beauty of Ayurveda, Shrankala, which you know and I know, that nothing in excess is great. And this is what I was explaining to them. I was like, if you're always sattvic, how will you have a life?
When yes, and you know, we need the rajas and we need
tamas.
Tamas at times, disdainful as I am of my personal tamas when it shows up. I'm like, let's get rid of it immediately, but please illuminate us.
Right. So I was like, let's start with the word that's so revered, sattva. And I was like, you know, I'm not poo-pooing on that word. The ultimate goal for all of us to navigate, I think it's the goal should be to navigate life through sattvic lens. Doesn't mean you always have to be sattvic. And I'll explain a little bit about that. So today my commute was, unfortunately, some gentleman got hit by a train. So the subway stopped. So I saw her. So as an Ayurvedic doctor, like I pause for 30 seconds. It's been a practice. I used to be like that high pitta. No, I need to react to everything. And Ayurveda has now taught me, no, like, can you just pause for 30 seconds and really connect with what is going on? So my first thing was, yes, there is chaos happening. I need to be at a certain place. But is the gentleman okay? Third thing was, oh my God. So there, I'll be experiencing all of these mahagunas. The sattva is that care for that person. Like, yeah. Is he okay? The rajas is like, oh my God, I needed to be here. And the tamas is like, I'll just go home. Mm-hmm. So none of these mahagunas are bad. So what I did was I took my 30 seconds. I saw innumerable New Yorkers getting all angry and upset. And I understand you have to get to work. So what Ayurveda has taught me is like, you observe what who's doing what. But at the same time, where are you going to get that information from? You have to act on something, which is rajas. The pause was tamas. The sattva was really sitting with that information. So I found an MTA professional who wasn't being bogged down with 50 other people, who just seemed to be like playing something on the phone. God bless them. And I was like, do you know any alternate route to get to this particular subway stop? Because Uber seems a little ridiculous right now. I've looked at it. And he said, you know what? You're just better off going, returning home because no other subway or bus is headed that way. And I can't tell you when the trains run again. So you see like how all of these mahagunas helped me make that decision. When Ayurveda wasn't a part of my life, Shankla, I would have been that person like, no, I'm going to do this. How can this happen to me? Everything was personalized. And even when I say, see how my body language changes. So imagine if this is happening externally, what's going on up here? So the anxiety that people have, the anger that we deal with, the depression, and from an Ayurvedic perspective, vata imbalance, and I'm oversimplifying, we all know they're different kinds, but just because people like to know the simple stuff, what do I do now with anxiety? It's like, oh, why did it happen to me? That's your rajas, but that's also like a pitta in your body, right? I was like, oh, no, nothing will happen. I'll just go home. That could be a kapha just saying I'm demotivated, or just tamas showing up as lethargy. So they all work well together, but it's also so important for us to know there's a time and place. Like you worked on, you touched on the word tamas, and I love that because we've been conditioned to think tamas is bad. But if we didn't have tamas, there would be no night. If we didn't have night, how do we slow down and rest? If we didn't have that passion, you and I won't, we didn't have that rajas, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. And if we didn't have that sattva in us, we wouldn't be holding space. With what's happening with politics and the world, there's just so much lack of holding space. We don't have to understand people's choices. We just have to hold space for our own and let people be. And I think that's where I think this conversation about mental well-being from an Ayurvedic perspective is so important, because we live in a world which is a ticking time bomb. Everyone is reacting. You know, no one is responding any longer. And then we think we go take online dosha quizzes and say, oh, my pitta is out of balance. I won't just drink tonight. It's not that simple. Ayurveda is very simple. There are no rules. Yet it's not that simple. There are many rules. So it's, yeah.
And, you know, it's a great segue into two follow-up questions. The first one is, we've gone down this wonderful balance of the gunas. While our audience has started to become a little bit more familiar with the doshas,
right?
Shweta, in your words, please break down the concept of gunas, which, again, I use these words I'm not proud of, such as they're doshas of the mind, they are qualities of the mind, because sometimes language, especially English language, doesn't really translate to some Ayurvedic principles. But what are the gunas?
So simply put, and I love that you asked that, because I think it's important to raise awareness of gunas. And because a lot of people, you know, who are new to Ayurveda, they just assume it's all about the doshas.
Yes.
Right? And like the traits, when they think even the mind traits are doshas. So simply put, doshas, as we know, we have our prakriti, our constitution, and it's a combination of doshas. It's your blueprint. This is your dosha. Let's think your blueprint. We move, keep moving away. This is getting into Vikruti. So an Ayurvedic practitioner's goal is to bring you back to balance, where your health is restored. This is happening on a physical level. Same thing is happening on a mental level. So there are the three gunas that we talk about, sattva, rajas, tamas. And I love that you said food is medicine and how it can be used to heal. So when we talk about food or personalities, we often think of doshas. Oh, we're getting into vata season. My vata is imbalanced, so I eat this food. this is how it, you know, my vata will get balanced. One way of looking at it, right? Similar thing with the mind. There are these qualities that we talked about that can be restored with diet, lifestyle, and in the yoga studios, that's when we talk about the sattvic state of being. So the mind and body, yes, they're connected, but an imbalance in one will lead to an imbalance in the other. So if we're going through this extremely tamasic phase of, you know, and so tamas, simply put, would be more of lethargy, darkness. So think of night as tamas. But also like lethargy, sort of wickedness for like, if you are into crime dramas. So crime of passion would be rajas, because passion is, and ambition and the desire and like also the burnout. That's all rajas in the mind, right? Like that go-getter thing. The Taipei New Yorker is a classic rajas.
That activity builder, the building, as yes. One would think about, usually is driven by rajas.
It's very much driven by rajas. And tamas would be, it's that darkness within. So my husband and I, we are fascinated by crime dramas that are very focused on
who is it?
Crime, right? And when you think of these sociopaths, psychopaths, serial killers, there's a lot of darkness. That's tamas. So I'm not saying we give them a sattvic diet and then we restore them back to balance. You do need to, should they choose to, they need to work with a psychotherapist. But diet plays a huge role. So just to give people an understanding, that's what tamas can be. So tamas in balance is also like after, you know, the holiday season, why do we turn in? But we need that little bit of lethargy, that little bit of darkness to really connect with yourself. But too much of it, loneliness becomes an epidemic in America. And same way when you think of sattva, when for those of us who thought about that man, because I was messaging with the manager of this rental space, I was like, I can't come in today. But my heart is also like, is the man okay? Like, does his family know? And she said the same thing. I hope he's okay. I don't know what's going on. That's sattva. So it's being in that balance, but also knowing that we are connected to others. Yes, I'm connected to my mind, body, spirit, but I'm also connected to you, Shankla. And we are connected to the people who are tuning in. And so it's important to honor your individual traits, but sattva also reminds us we are all connected. If one of us suffers, all of us suffer. So that one gentleman who suffered because the train hit him, the commuters suffered because there were delays. But also it puts that fear of, it could be any of us next time if we're not careful. And God alone knows what happened. His family suffered. So as a result, the family's co-workers will suffer. Their friends will suffer. So if we can just understand our actions, and sattva reminds us, if our actions, if we can think of them, it's our world is beyond I, me, myself. It's a human, sattva teaches us about humanity. Does that help?
It does hugely, because it touches on so many important aspects, our interconnectivity as human beings, first and foremost, but also about the balance of light and dark.
Right.
You know, it's easy to think that creation is what we need, but no, we also need rest and destruction, because that's how the universe works. It is all about, you know, we talk about doshic balance, but also the guna balance. And it's easy to sort of judge something as wholly bad or wholly good, but it never is. And Ayurveda is a great reminder of always having, you know, having that space and that sattvic thinking even around a guna, or what you traditionally thought as a good or bad thought, or a good or bad way of being, or a good or bad food. As we constantly preach in Ayurveda, there's no such thing as a superfood per se. You know, there are some things that work for most people, but Ayurveda doesn't paint everything as good or bad. And sort of building on sort of like balance and going a little bit towards imbalances, this is something you see a lot in your practice. I'd love to hear, what are some of the most common types of imbalances you see? Are they seasonally related? Are they related to New York? And how do you counsel your clients to find balance?
Oh, I just, after your question gave me goosebumps. It's so specific and also universal at the same time. So the one thing that I have, so I read somewhere, Shankla, that 80% of Americans are navigating a wealth imbalance. So
I concur.
Right? So I think even if you're in a big city like a New York or a Miami, there are other reasons why we have wealth imbalances. But you, if you are in smaller towns, an erratic lifestyle could be, yeah, you know, it's not just the commute that causes vata imbalance, right? It's so many factors. So the one thing that I've been seeing, and Ayurveda approaches it so differently, is unaddressed grief. That's the root cause of so many illnesses. And that grief.
Oh my gosh, that gave me goosebumps. You know, I'm going to hand this back to you in a second, but I recently did a program called Hoffman, which was a week long shut out the world. And it's often focused on childhoods. I went to boarding school very young, and it's incredible how much unprocessed grief we all hold. I did not realize I had sort of like that grief and trauma about an experience that I largely held as playful and fun, being with girlfriends since the age of 9 and growing out of that through 17. And it was a little shocking to accept that I had a lot of grief around that. But yes, grief. We maybe are taught to just brush it under a rug and not address it or not hold space for it or not acknowledge it. But please tell us more about grief.
Absolutely. So we have, you and I have another thing in common. I'm a boarding school child as well. Lots of unpacking. And, you know, it wasn't until I started working on my grief that I realized that is what is bringing these people to me. They don't recognize it as grief. And I don't call it grief unless they are ready, because I'm also a trauma-informed yoga teacher. So I'm like, I know that language of when to not say something that somebody is not ready for. If someone doesn't sign up for my trauma-informed yoga class, but, you know, their trauma shows up in my regular yoga class, I know the distinction. And people acknowledge their grieving in their own time. The other thing is, I love what you said. It's so candid. It's the world is not equipped to handle grief. And when we are told grief, we just think death off.
Yeah.
The grief is a response to any kind of loss. It could be loss of an opportunity. Yes, the intensity would differ if you don't get that. Whatever it is that matters to a teenager at Sephora, right? That is grief to them. And who are we to say that grief doesn't matter? And then there is grief hierarchy. There is grief comparison. There is like whose grief matters more. And because people are not equipped to deal with grief, the grievers don't know how to talk about their grief. So I work with a lot of Gen Zs, college kids just getting to college. And a lot of them develop gut issues or anxiety. And very often people will say, it's the colleges in America. You know, they just don't know how to serve food. I mean, we all know the world for the most developed countries who are supposed to be thriving, they don't have the best foods. We say it's organic. We say it's farm to table, all of that. But you know what? How many people can afford that? Especially when you're in college. And is that really the quality? Somebody else was saying, I got fruits and vegetables from the farmer's market and they lasted me for a week. I was like, yeah, you have to question the quality of that. Right?
Yeah.
So we have all these big conversations, but when I'm talking to these kids who are on a budget, as they should be, because that's how you learn about life. You need to get your part-time jobs. But, you know, especially when you're coming from a South Asian family, you've for the most part been raised with warm food, somebody doing your laundry. You don't have to worry about who's going to pay for this. All of a sudden, there is this anxiety and the grief of moving away. We don't talk about that. The grief of not having a support structure. We don't talk about that. So when I'm dealing with these kids, and then, you know, I work a lot with, actually, I used to say women in their 30s, 40s, 50s, but there are a lot of men in their 40s who are now working with me. And the big thing is now, after a few conversations, they start using the word grief. I was like, can we go back to that point and address the elephant in the room? Because then it's out of your system. You know, if you need to work with a therapist, that's a whole separate conversation. So anxiety and insomnia very often rooted, or gut health issues, rooted in grief that is unprocessed, unaddressed, and goes unrecognized. Because a lot of these kids feel guilty that, oh, I am so privileged. I'm able to go to this college and I don't have to take out a loan because, you know, my family will take care of it. But then the grief of moving away, if you've never lived away from home, all of a sudden you're sharing a room or an apartment or whatever have you with a stranger. All of a sudden you need to figure out what you're going to eat. Are the subjects that work for you? Even when I say that, I'm, there is a sense of loneliness. So yes, you're amongst 50 people, but there is a sense of isolation as well. So I am insomnia and anxiety, very much a big thing that I'm working with for younger kids, Gen Zs, and then for adults. It's a lot of gut health issues and also respiratory issues. And then when we start talking, and that's where the storytelling comes in handy, because we start sharing stories and we realize what you just said, it goes back to 4 decades ago. You know, it's unresolved stuff like, oh, thyroid problem. What have we not expressed? So I don't mean to bring voodoo stuff into it, but like, yes, there is hyperthyroidism. There is hypothyroidism. There are all these autoimmune diseases. Why is it that 60% of women deal with autoimmunes versus men? Are we not
I don't think we are in a world, fortunately, anymore that those connections are not understood. I mean, epigenetics is really something that is coming to the foreground, in that trauma can be generational and carried through. So I appreciate the caveat. I also just wanted to say that I'm encouraged that we are now holding space about just the stuff that you're talking about, in terms of we're starting to recognize that it is more than what a limited amount of science and research around a topic can explain. So
absolutely.
I love that you're giving us all these clues about areas to look in when you're dealing with an issue that seems often insoluble. And I'm sure a lot of us have those 2 or 3 elephants that we've been working on resolving, and there's no sort of magic bullet, because right. You have to look in many, many corners to help bring them to their natural resolution. And I'm going to ask 2 questions that I kind of dislike asking, because every journey is so personal. And one of my go-to recommendations, even if no one's asking, is, you know, figure out your own healing journey. Work with practitioners. They'll help you figure that out. So I hate this idea of sort of like one size fits all ask. But first, would you feel comfortable sharing a journey or 2 of resolution so that our listeners can start to see a path forward with a practitioner like yourself around what does healing or a solution look like?
Absolutely. So there's, because we were talking about the, I gave that example of thyroid, you know, a young client and comes to me, we're talking about, oh, I have weight gain, I have this. So we first talk about what, you know, and it's been like, she's been recommended, oh, you can take these pills to lose that weight. And when she came to me, my whole thing was, do you want to find out why the weight gain has happened? And this is why I tell people, don't take dosha quizzes online, because you can do the prakriti on your own. You can't figure out your imbalances. That's the role of a practitioner. So yes, you think you're treating yourself, but we need to work on your imbalances. And you might think, oh, I take this quiz, now I'll fix my diet and lifestyle and these herbs to work on the prakriti. So you're making yourself sicker. So she came in and I was like, I'll ask you questions. If you feel uncomfortable, you don't have to answer them. But my job is to ask you questions, some things that you haven't thought about. All to honor the confidentiality. But what happened was, we realized there was trouble. So, and by not just trouble, I mean a geographic location change for this client. So there's anxiety around that.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, living on their own, renting a space as opposed to roommates, money coming in from their job. So it's like, oh, I can eat out. I can do all of this. Portion control goes out the window, right? But then there is also that loneliness. But then when we started working, and I'm like, yes, from an Ayurvedic perspective, we work on your thyroid. You keep working with your medical practitioner. And so end result, I'll share that. She's lost the weight off any of the levothyroxine, no longer on medication. But what we traced it back to was, this is the first time this person is living as an adult and has a boss that where a manager where there is no, where they don't see eye to eye. And this person is not allowed to express themselves in meetings. So we think, no, it's just, oh, you're eating too much. And that's what the parents were saying, you're eating too much. But why is this person eating too much? What is it that they're trying to control? The control that they don't have in the 9 to 7 any longer. So we started, so what I did was, yes, put them on some Ayurvedic herbs to work on the thyroid. Also, you know, the Langana aspect, like how do we reduce the toxins, but also the fat? How do we get the Agni going? What was really, and you know, the pranayams and everything that we, the workouts, like, I'm a big, big, big fan of weight training for women over 25, right?
Yeah.
So getting all of that into place. And I'm like, okay, you don't want to do yoga? Don't do it. Go do Pilates. Don't run 5K. And she, this person loved Pilates. But what was also the big thing was working on the throat chakra and the sacral chakra. They're connected, the third and the fifth, right? It's also bringing them back to balance. And ultimately, this person couldn't talk to the boss because wall, but found a new job. So it's also being action-oriented. Yes, I'm not going to tell you, go punch someone. That's not my style. Or if you're not comfortable speaking up, don't. Then we figure out how else you... So you speak up and you find another avenue, but there has to be a solution. You know, the action-oriented is that Rajas in us, right?
So right.
Ultimately, this person found a new job. We were working through their transition on mentally, you know, the nervousness of even speaking to a manager who doesn't hold space. So what kind of pranayam to do before you have that meeting? What kind of pranayam to do? Go into the bathroom, lock yourself up. What kind of breath work to do after you've had that conversation? Because this person will demean you, will make you feel small, but you are more than what they think of you. But you know, when you're 25, 26, we, even as adults, we look for external validation. So it was the diet and lifestyle which worked with the weight loss, but it was the breath work and the chakra balancing work that really gave them the space to say, I am better than what I am, where I am now, or what I'm being showed. So this person would have been open to affirmations, but I was like, no, you be more action-oriented. I also know, like, the Pitamai person wants to see, I'm doing this, what's the result? Thriving now, a year later, off all medications, 20 pounds lighter. And this is the beauty of Ayurveda. I didn't do anything. I was just as a guide. They did it. And now they know that I'm like, don't keep coming back to me. I know, bad business sense, but ethically, I'm equipping you and empowering you to be able to make these decisions the next time you're in a situation. Just because your manager today is great doesn't mean it always works out that way. But yes, if there is a health crisis, you know where to find me. So this was one case that was incredible. The other was a doctor that I worked with, and a male doctor. And his whole goal was, he's like, I want to be, how much is 30 kilos? Because he didn't live in the US. I want to say
about 60, actually 75. It's about, you know, 2.2. So yeah, 67, if you will, 67.
And his goal was to lose weight before this big conference. And that's the amount of weight he lost. And the weight loss was, I was like,
that's
no.
Significant.
That's significant. And you know, he's a doctor. So I'm like, you keep doing your blood work if should you choose that route. But I'm like, I need you to become active with your choices before. And I don't, people don't, will not put people on Ayurvedic herbs. I was like, you replacing pills from Western medicine and replacing them with Ayurvedic herbs, I'm not going to get you onto that. Like, work with somebody else if that's what you choose. I need to see in a couple of sessions you're willing to do the work with your diet and lifestyle. And he did. So with him, we worked very intensively. So we would meet once a week for a Zoom yoga practice. I would evaluate his diet, what he'd eaten. We monitor, because that was his goal. Like, I'm not a proponent of lose weight unless you want to. You need to come tell me this is one of my goals. Like, I'm not into body shaming people. So for him, because the time period was short and this was his goal, the other thing to do was, what led to this weight gain? I'm like, don't judge yourself. That's happened. But what happened? And, you know, couples with young kids, both husband and wife working, and, you know, they're both doctors and they have very little space in their lives. So the whole thing became, can we make cooking an act family activity? So in the evening, eat simpler. But so I gave him, like, I would give him weekly menus for what they could expect. I was like, we'll make it simpler for you. But he did the work. I was like, at the end of week one, if I feel you haven't done the thing, then I'm not wasting my time and energy. right? So I'm pretty strict like that. We have a lot of fun, but like there's a, you hired me for accountability. So he did that. And I was like, okay, you know, I understand as a young parent, you might feel guilty leaving your wife with the two kids when she's working. What if you join the Y and you make swimming a family activity? Or the kids are in camp, you and wife use that as a time, as a workout date. Mm-hmm. Then summertime, how about you go for a walk? So instead of, I was like, what does the traditional end of work day look like? Like 80% of families, it's television and food. It's like, what if you eat your dinner and then the kids can go biking in your neighborhood and you and your wife are walking? So it's still easy. It's not like, oh my God, I have to run and perform. You're also catching up with each other. So it became, so in this case, in the first case, it was working with that individual, their mindset, empowering them and letting them believe like you roar and you soar. But with this person was like, how do we make this a family lifestyle change where it's not like, oh, it's a Diwali party or it's Thanksgiving and I need to shove food down. No, like how do we look at food with an abundance mindset? And so a lot of this person's colleagues were very, very surprised. Like, how did you lose that weight? And it was just connecting with yourself, connecting with food, changing your relationship. And I think that's what is the beauty with Ayurveda, right? Like you said this earlier, customized healing. But it's also what he didn't realize was I also worked on his anxiety around weight without calling it anxiety.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he's a medical practitioner. He doesn't want to be told he's dealing with. There might be some anxiety around weight. But the fact that you reach out to me saying, I need to be like this because I don't like the way I look. And I'm like, it started with that. But then I was like, that's a short-term goal. How can we make it a long-term goal where you as a human being, you're enjoying good health? You know, you're enjoying a balanced family life. And we talked about the options of how they could join and sort of volunteer at certain parks in the neighborhood. So the kids are active. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yes, you know, some of your old friends will not get your new lifestyle. And so let them be. You can't change people. But will you let that hold you back? Or are you willing to put yourself out there and connect with newer people? So they now have a newer friend circle. People who are active. People who look at food as, yeah, I'm going to enjoy that slice of pie with ice cream. But it's not going to be about have a bad day and I'm going to have four drinks and four slices. Life of moderation. So he realized that a life of permission is so much more helpful mentally versus 6 days you don't eat and on the seventh day you're doing that cheat eating. It doesn't work for him or his family. So they're just active, healthier. The kids are now participating in competitive sports because how the parents approach life, that has changed. It's not about this big brunch at home. It's about this big family quality time together. That might involve a brunch. That might involve 2 hours in the pool.
Such heartwarming stories. I love both of them because distinct and for two individuals in completely different circumstances, but that common thread of being in touch with your true feelings and feeling empowered and then moderation in what you do. Sometimes, yes, we are not in a position where we can change our boss. So the moderate answer is not, you know, fixing that person and speaking your piece. Maybe it is about finding the most right thing, which is finding another job. And that's not, you know, those two are not binary answers, one or the other. There are so many, but it is allowing yourself the space to figure out what's right for you in a moderate, balanced way. And, you know, those stories are such beacons of what life can hold for us. And it kind of empowers me to ask the second question that I don't like asking, given that, you know, every journey is so individual. But Sweta, in the case that an individual doesn't have a practitioner that they have access to, or it's not in the repertoire right away, what are some of the areas they should look at as they start to try to balance some of these imbalances we've talked about?
Absolutely. So the one thing, you know, we talk a lot about self-love and self-care, but in a way,
these days,
and I think that's the myth I want to debunk today, because if you can start looking at yourself with genuine love, I'm not saying looking at yourself in the mirror and from a vanity perspective, if that's what, you know, speaks to you, go ahead, do that as well. But I know a lot of women and a lot of my clients, but also friends, family, who everything is about the other. And I struggle with it too. Like, I have to remind myself, it's okay to prioritize you. So self-care doesn't just have to be a spa day. It doesn't have to be dinner and drinks with your girlfriend. So tomorrow your friends move or you have a falling out, you know, or you just grow each other out. Or you're in different spaces in life. You know, one person is single, the other is divorced, the other has four kids. You might not always find the same camaraderie. So self-care needs to be more of an internal process. You know, you might think, oh, I'll get like the best glass of wine, go to this restaurant. What happens if you lose a job? Right? Mm. Or you deal with a health crisis. You don't have access to that. So the whole beauty of Ayurveda is making self-care sustainable and radically available on a daily basis. So the first thing would be creating pauses in your day. And that's scary because when we pause, that's when we know of the BS that's going on within us. You know, it's so easy when we are constantly moving to blame others. We all have done that or keep doing it. It's when you pause, ask yourself, where do I need that change, that transformation? What could I do to feel better? And that what could I, you might not have that answer. But the first suggestion would be, if you don't have access to a myriad of reasons to talk to an Ayurvedic practitioner, is asking yourself what doesn't feel right. Is it my sleep? Is it my elimination? Is that my personal circle of friends and family? Is it my job? Is it how I react to certain situations? Is it the lack of reaction in certain situations? Be honest with yourself. It might not happen in one day. It might take a Rome wasn't built in a day. So be patient with yourself just the way you are with a five-year-old or with a pet, right? Give yourself that same love and compassion. The second part of self-care would be, what brings you joy? And again, it's we've been told, conditioned to believe life should be a highlighted reels on Instagram, right? Living my hashtag, living my best life. No one's life is that great. Let's just accept it. But what is great is, how are we showing up? Right? So ask yourself, what brings you joy? You know, sometimes for me, like if my husband is traveling, I've had a really busy week and he doesn't get in until midnight on Friday. And a friend wants to meet up for dinner on Friday. I was like, no, I'll do a takeout. But I really want to come home, do Abhyanga, watch something completely mindless on television, be disconnected where I'm not engaged with the world. He's texted me. He's in the flight. I like can put my phone on airplane mode and shut down. To me, that's self-care. But it's not always possible. So sometimes it's just sipping a cup of tea. Again, look at what you can afford and what you have access to. And I don't just mean monetarily afford, like in terms of time also, right? In terms of health, if you're differently abled and you can't get to point A to B, like what else brings you joy? Is it connecting with a loved one? For me, Shankla, I live in an urban jungle. And, you know, like in parks, we have more dogs running around. Sometimes there's squirrels like who are bullying you. And then squirrels went rabid during pandemic in the city.
I have heard.
Right? Like rabid squirrels jumping on your shoulders. They were unafraid. Or very often cities are dealing with homelessness, right? So there is also, you might encounter a homeless person on a bench and that's their place to be. But yet I love going to parks because there's something so equalizing about being near trees where it just tells you this belongs to all of us. So loneliness is an epidemic in America, right? And you might not, again, always have access to, for me, my social connections are very important. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's through a text message. You can't always hop on a train to see people. But when I get to a park, or if I stand under a tree, it just reminds me how humbling and equalizing this place belongs to a homeless man as much as it belongs to that rabid squirrel or a dog or a butterfly or me. So find what grounds you. So it might not always be a meditation practice. You know, if you've had a bad day, it's hard to shut your mind off. So just a simple practice of just being in nature. You know, and if you don't have access to a lake, just the way I don't, but I do have access to a park across from my building, I'll just go be there. And there's a gentleman who's practicing an instrument and all of that. And you find the joy of just being in the moment. So yes, it might not be, and one simple diet thing that I'll give It's because I don't want to judge people how they cook, because I don't know their background in terms of how is it that they're putting a meal on the table. But to the extent that you can, try to eat warm meals. You know, they're just better for your gut. And what I mean by that is your digestive system, from an Ayurvedic perspective, understands cooked foods better than it does uncooked food. So even if it's that salad that you're eating, toss it with a spoon of ghee or olive oil or coconut oil and toss it together and add that love that you spend on others. Be aware of what you're feeding yourself. We are so disconnected. And that's the last thing, like, spend time outside of technology, disconnected. Spend times without Instagram telling you how crappy your life is and everyone else has hit like a jackpot. None of that is true. And you know, when we disconnect from the gadgets, from the television, eat in peace, walk. Like when I walk, I don't listen to podcasts or music. I will just, a short walk, long walk is different. A short walk, I just want to observe what I'm feeling in that moment. We are so conditioned to be disconnected from what we feel. We take on other people's feelings, what we watch on YouTube, on television, on a commuter rail or things like that, right? So learn to connect deeply with yourself. Remember, if you can, eat warm foods. Keep yourself hydrated. Connect with the world outside of you, because that rabbit squirrel is also connected to each one of us. And find what brings you joy. Just because it's not highlighted on social media doesn't mean you don't have the right to feel joy in pursuing something.
Sweta, there is so much I could keep talking to you about. You know, we haven't even touched on yoga and how you tailor practices to bring up emotion and release it, especially, you know, because it flies in the face of how often yoga is practiced in a very vinyasa focused one size fits all practice. So I do know we will be talking very soon again and talking about so many things that you brought up. But I do love that we're ending on this wonderful story of you being in the park, both as an individual, acknowledging individual feelings, but the universality of everything and every being that is connected with you in that park, and that we're individuals that lead this life and this energy in the universe together, is that beautiful dichotomy and that balance of Ayurveda, and such wise words to live by. And before I let you go, I realize we're at time. Any additional nuggets of wisdom you want to share with us?
Just a reminder over and over again. I was also raised, I wasn't told, but I saw the women around me, even though, you know, my family was pretty progressive, that, you know, self-care is something you do when you're not doing this. Make self-care a daily practice. And what Shankla and I were talking about, it could be sitting in a corner and enjoying your cup of hot tea or coffee, if that's silence. And the other thing I would say is, again, learn to connect with yourself. You know, the differences that we have with people, why we get upset, it's because we have been trained to see ourselves through other people's lenses. So when you know who you are, what triggers you, what brings you joy, automatically your relationships transform, because self-care becomes a modality of setting healthy boundaries. So don't be afraid to practice it.
Very wise words to live by. Thank you again, Sweta. So enjoyed this conversation. If our audience can get 10% of the enjoyment I got and everything I learned, I would call this a major win. Can't wait to have you back. And thank you again for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me. I had an incredible time talking to you.
Voted as one of the most influential Asians of our times and winner of the Voices of the Year Award, past recipients of which include Chelsea Clinton, Sweta lives in New York City with her husband and works with clients across the globe. She also teaches yoga, meditation, and mindfulness to survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. Please go to umaoils.com/Sweta to learn more about Sweta.
As we conclude this episode, we invite you to delve deeper into the world of Ayurveda with Uma. Please subscribe to the Uma Ayurveda podcast to continue this transformative journey with our series of conversations that we hope you'll find enlightening. Visit umaoils.com, that is UMAOILS.com, for an even more immersive experience exploring not only our luxury Ayurveda products, but also an array of inspired wellness insight and lifestyle tips.